Welcome to Cloudlandia.
Mr. Sullivan.
Yes, Mr. Jackson.
Welcome to Cloudlandia.
And what was the exact nature of a $1 billion offer that you got this week that you turned down? It undervalued your value.
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's see. I don't think I had an offer like that this week. What do you think?
Yeah. Mr. Beast did.
Oh, I know. Isn't that something? No, I don't think so. But, you know, somebody broke down did the math on it, you know, compared to like a Super Bowl commercial, which is, you know, $7 million or something for, a 30-second Super Bowl commercial. And they broke down the number each month that he has of that number of reach. And it was like, it was great. Yeah, he was absolutely right to turn down $1 billion for his channel. Very interesting, isn't it? These are amazing times. And it's a perfect.
Well, the interesting thing about it is the person who is making the offer would actually end up with more or less nothing if Mr. Beast did. Because first of all, would there be a section in the contract where he would have to produce, or
continue
would they just
to produce,
buy what he produce or create, or is he clear and free? Because if he's clear and free, he'll just go out and do it again, and they'll end up with nothing.
And I wonder, that, you know, you think about that, that there's certainly a more sense of fleeting value in the Mr. Beast catalog sort of thing. You know, I don't know what's going to happen now in, 40 years. Is this going to be a valuable catalog? I've seen this cascading thing of all these great, musical artists from the 70s and 60s and 80s now they're selling their catalogs. I just saw that, Neil Young had sold 50% of his catalogs for $150 million. And I thought Bruce Springsteen had sold they're selling half of their catalog for these big upfront sums. And I remember it was interesting because I believe that David Bowie was the first to have done that, to create Bowie bonds. And it was some crazy amount of money that he was, hundreds of millions that he was paid for his catalog. But I had an interesting thought about that this week because I've been thinking about, if I look at a timeline, if I plot them on a timeline and they're on the base and then a rise in their ubiquity or sort of peak, fully realized, if you go from Gutenberg 14, whatever, and then
55.
You go in the order that they were created, basically was text and then sound and then picture and then video, moving pictures, right? So the big four categories of content creation. And if you think about that, those four sort of all converged by 1900, they were kind of all created. By 1950, they kind of reached the peak of their, I'll call it ubiquitousness or their accessibility, that they're fully realized. You could, in practice, there was a way to capture, record, to, preserve, to create all of it, print, pictures, video, audio. And, I mentioned before that it didn't seem like there was much advancement that led into a long period of years until we got to the digitization of those things. And it followed the same path of words for text first, sound with the MP3, pictures and the pegs, and then video. And by, YouTube, it had reached everything was in place. But now in 2022, we're at the point where all of those things, it's kind of like another peak level of both production, the preserving and the distribution and consumption of all of those things is at a plateau level. And I've said it kind of before that I don't know where we can improve on the production, consumption, distribution, all of those things. We basically have every piece of any of those media that's ever been created or will be, can be created, instantly available to us on any device and distributable to anybody in the world, right? We can instantly, that's what Mr. Beast is doing. And I was thinking about that from the 50s on, that it was really an era of then people capitalizing on the use of those tools as opposed to the creation of those tools. And now, so we look at what's happening now, and if you say, you know, Mr. Beast, and as the perfect example of a content creator who's built, used those tools, used the ability to create video, preserve it, and distribute it, that, you know, you see that now and build an audience around that, that those are the big, those are the big wins, I think.
Now. Yeah.
Just thinking, what's the next 20 years look like, you know?
Yeah, well, I've got three insights from what you've just said. There are some people from the 70s who are getting big payoffs now, and you name some of the big ones, but there's 9,999 other artists from the 70s who aren't getting a dime. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So you have to understand that history cherry picks. In other words, you cherry pick backwards and you say, this was worth it. But that was based on the fact that these people had a continuous following from the 70s up until
an audience.
Up until
an audience.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the big national audiences stopped around halfway through the 70s. And there's some interesting evidence of that, that when you look at tours, you know, annual tours, generally speaking, 7 out of 10 of the biggest tours will be musicians who are in their 70s. It won't be
legacy artists,
bright,
right?
It won't be new, bright, you know, bright young artists. They won't be there,
right?
And because bright young artists can't create national audiences anymore, because they're all the distributions are really fragmented down into niches. Okay, so you may be the 900-pound gorilla for a niche, but your niche in comparison with all the other niches really isn't very significant. I mean, when Elvis appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, he got 85% of American televisions that night.
Yeah.
You know, that way. Yeah. There isn't anybody who can get more than about, 10%, you know, of a...
Well, there's less. I saw now the ratio that, there's hardly any shows now that have 10 million viewers. 10 million is like a huge number now for a TV show. There was an article about that with the upfront, the big showcase at the year that the networks kind of show what they've got in the lineup and how it's really dropping precipitously, you know, and it's all about streaming now. It's all about the streaming catalog.
Yeah. I think what Mr. Beast is a bit of a unique character in the sense that he's going to make his billion anyway. So he doesn't really have to take a billion from anybody now because he's going to make the billion. He's going to make the billion anyway, and he knows it, you know. But the other thing is, the moment that he's bought, he stops creating.
Right. Yeah, that's
so
what I wonder.
What they're trying to buy is a creator, and I don't think they're available. I don't think you can buy a creator, because creators only create when they're not reporting to someone.
That's the truth, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something about
Yeah, it's kind of like the people who are doing the buying are looking at this as a commodity that they can add to their investment portfolio. You know, this is a prime piece of sirloin steak that we can, you know, we can put into ground beef and sell it off in pieces 5 years from now. You know,
yeah.
But yeah, so they know the price of everything, but the value of nothing. And I think he's sensing that, but I think it was a good, you know, I think getting an offer like that is a really important measurement for someone like him. He says, billion, that's interesting, because
yeah.
he said that lets me sort of gauge against what the impact is, the network that I've created, the YouTube subscriber base that I've created, but also, you know, the popularity of the Mr. Beast, the Beast Burger
yeah.
restaurants, and how they're doing,
yeah.
and the specialty foods that he's creating, the chocolates and everything like that. So it gives him a yardstick. I mean, it's probably from his standpoint at 24, 8 years after he started his project, getting a $1 billion offer is probably pretty good. You know, it's a good measurement.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's pretty amazing that he would have that opportunity. You know, when you think about, you know, 6 years ago, sitting in his bedroom, hoping that he had 1 million subscribers by the time he, you know, 5 years later, when he did the me in 5 years video.
You know what I would do if I were him, and I'm not, and I want to make it clear that I'm not. But I would do a show where he's receiving the offer for $1 billion and then just takes everybody through his thinking of why he's not going to accept $1 billion. And
right.
then he puts it out to his 160 million audience. And he said, you know, this is the biggest offer I've gotten. But what I got in mind for some projects we're going to create in the future are just a lot more exciting to me. And, you know, this would just kind of delay me a bit, and it might, you know, bog me down a bit, and I just want to get on with the new things that I'm creating. And he just turns this into nah, the creativity is more important than the billion. And he's making 54 million a month anyway, so
mm-hmm.
He made 54 million last year. Well, you know, he's a kid from North Carolina. His tastes
right.
haven't probably shot through the roof over the last year.
Yeah. And that's a really interesting, you know, thing that he's, you know, really proven. You don't have to be anywhere. The Todlandia outposts can be anywhere. That's for one thing.
Yeah.
You know, he's in the middle of nowhere, North Carolina, and
yeah.
That didn't stop him. And he surrounded himself with the people right there. All the people that are the core people in his channel are his friends from right there in North Carolina. So it shows, you know, anybody has access to all the riches of Cloudlandia, but it's the idea
yeah.
and the execution that count. I saw it. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's just interesting. I was doing a podcast with Jeff Madoff about 2 weeks ago.
About forever anything and everything?
People. Yeah, anything and everything. Yeah, that's
about anything and everything.
That's a real narrow focus, isn't it? We got ourselves
yeah,
down
I love
to
it.
Really narrow. focus. And so anyway, Jeff is, for those listeners who don't know, Jeff is a, you know, he's a veteran, very well experienced, very superb creator of video. For example, the opening of fashion seasons for big design houses and that, he'll create the video that presents, you know, the mm-hmm. new fashion season out to the world. And he's done lots of documentaries, and he teaches marketing at the New School in New York,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, an all-around fascinating conversationalist. But anyway, we were just talking about pricing, you know, how you price yourself in the marketplace. And I'm actually writing my quarterly book on this subject this quarter. So
what's it
I'm
called?
Interested in the topic. The title of this one is called Capitalism and Everything Else.
Yeah, okay. Capitalism and everything.
Yeah, there's a methodology called capitalism, and the first step of capitalism that is that you price yourself in a way that appreciates what your value is. In other words, and appreciates a great word, Dean. I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but appreciate can mean, on the one hand, it can mean sort of grateful. You know, you appreciate something, you're grateful for it. But it also has an economic term, which means to increase the value of. You appreciate the, you know, real estate appreciates, gold appreciates, stocks appreciate. You know, so that, so it's an interesting word. And so anyway, I was telling him that in my early coach days, probably program started in 1989. So this would have been probably 93, 94. And I had a guy from California who was a big deal compared to most of the other clients that were in coach at that time. And he had his own jet. He flew his jet into Toronto for the workshops. And he came up to me and he said, you know, I get a lot out of these workshops, but I'd like to, I've got something I want to think through. And I'd like to offer you to get picked up on a Friday with my jet brought out to California. We spend the whole weekend at my place. I got great guest houses and everything else. And fly you back on Sunday night and $50,000 for that. So it was $50,000 in 1994 dollars and US dollars. And I said, well, I'll tell you right now, that would be a no. And he said, "Ha, you didn't even think about it." I said, well, I have thought about it. I'm just giving you the conclusion of my previous thinking. And I said, I did one-on-one coaching for 15 years, and I exhausted the possibilities of it. And I got to the point where I didn't think I could learn anything more from doing one-on-one coaching. And we switched over to the workshop setting. And I learned a lot more from the workshop setting than I did one-on-one. So, you know, that weekend, I wouldn't learn anything. So that wouldn't be worth it to me. It wouldn't be worth it to me.
There you go. What was his response?
It was kind of ambivalent. You know, it was kind of ambivalent because I think it might have been a new experience for him.
For somebody saying no. Yeah, exactly.
Well, or whatever. You know, I mean, I didn't think that. I didn't think his side of it through. I just thought, you know, that it would throw kind of a wrench into what we were doing in coach and everything, you know. And, you know, like it would be off topic. It would be off strategy. It would be off, you know, off topic and, you know, and everything like that. And, you know, and that's been my total attitude. Now I won't even travel, period. You know, like somebody wants to have me speaker that I won't travel. You know, I mean, I'll do a Zoom call.
Yeah,
I'll do
course,
a Zoom
right.
call if the people watching are likely signups for a coach. You know, that would be the only condition of what I would do it. And my sense is that one of the things is that you can go as far as you want in life if you always know your value and what enhances your value. Yeah. And money, there's a point where money isn't going to enhance your value.
Well, it's very, I mean, and you look at Mr. Beast, he's just discovered that that's true. Even, you know, he's
at
got a
24
very,
years old, at 24 years old,
but he's already realized, he's already gone through that arc very quickly. When he first started making money, he bought a couple of cars and he bought a big house and the things and fancy clothes and stuff. And he realized this is all kind of crazy. And somebody broke into his house and stole all of his clothes and stuff, and he realized, okay, this is kind of silly anyway. So he kind of, you know, has a what he calls a regular house now, and he's actually got a, he lives almost mostly at his big studio. He's got a place in his studio where he, you know, does, wakes up, he's got his workout equipment right beside his bed. So he gets out of bed, he goes right to working out, right to the shower, and then right to eat a little breakfast, and then he goes right to work. And that's his whole environment is set up to support his number one goal, which is to make the most amazing YouTube videos possible.
Yeah.
Nothing, everything else distracts from it.
Yeah.
I saw it.
Yeah, and that, you know, and that is, you know, I think the whole point is that so much emphasis probably over the last 20 years, you know, with the internet becoming a more workable medium, you know, and more accessible medium, all the emphasis was on reach. You know, it was on reach. And then you get to the point where you can reach anything at any point, any time, you know, and then there's got to be a coming around the circle to, is there anything, I mean, you can fill it up with content, but is the content worth watching?
Now that's the thing. That's where we're at, isn't it? That now the content has to be, because we have so much choice and over choice, where nobody's just accepting mediocre content. Like you could have, you know, in the, you know, 60s or things, there wasn't as much, like, you know, on the quality of stuff. Where now,
the moment you heard the national anthem, you know there wasn't going to be any more content for six
that's
hours.
It. We're done. That's enough. Yeah, that's enough for the day. But now it's anything you want at any time. And it's just but you know, where we run into I mentioned before that the real finite resource is our attention. And that's all we have, you know.
Yeah.
It's pretty.
Yeah. I would say lack of choice is no longer the problem. I think probably lack of purpose. I think lack of purpose is really a much bigger problem than lack of choice.
I saw a video interview with Mr. Beast. He wasn't in it, but they were talking about having spent a weekend with him. I sometimes watch the podcast that they had spent a weekend with Mr. Beast in the context of a bunch of other entrepreneurs in North Carolina all kind of getting together. The guy intentionally set up the gathering in North Carolina so that it would be super easy if Mr. Beast wanted to stop by, and he did come and spend the weekend. But they said he's got two guys with him at all times, whose only job is to make whatever he wants to happen. 24 hours a day, they're sitting there. They were having the idea at 10:30 at night. Somebody said, yeah, we should like go play basketball. And Mr. Beast guys were like right on it, calling around, trying to find a high school or somewhere where they could go and play basketball, like just any, they chased his wins kind of thing, you know, whatever he wants to have happen, they'd make it happen right away. And they've got basically a positive attitude, unlimited budget. So whatever it is, whatever it costs, okay, well, what if we gave you $50,000 or whatever? Like, you know, your guy was kind of used to probably whatever he wants, people will, the unlock magic key is money, which you would think, you know, you're saying in the 90s, $50,000 was a lot different than $50,000 now, but your, you know, purpose, your, you were clear that's not the unlock for you.
No, you know, and the big thing is that Diamandis has a great, you know, a great line. He says, everybody thinks that creativity is thinking outside of the box. He said, actually, it's thinking in a much smaller box. In other words, most people are in a box. I mean, we're all in a box of some sort if you take space, time, you know, available resources, opportunity, you know, you have limitations.
Yeah.
And a lot of people say, well, you know, I would be creative and I would be productive if I wasn't constrained by my conditions. But if you go back to the 16-year-old Jimmy Donaldson, who's AKA Mr. Beast, you know, when you showed me the first videos, he was constrained by his circumstances.
Yeah.
And the reason why he found YouTube is because that was the one escape he had from his situation. So it was only because he was constrained that he found the solution. If he had had the two guys when he was 16, you know, that could get him anything he wanted at a snap of the finger, yeah, he wouldn't have created anything over the last 8 years.
And it's a bit ironic. I mean,
I think he's just having a little bit of fun now, you know, and
yeah,
you know, and because
I was just going to say, if you really look at it, he's discovered that the magic secret of what's in it for them, and that life gives to the giver, as our friend Joe Polish would say. That is the key. The turning point for him was when he started giving away money and giving away things to people. Everything switched. You know, the very first brand thing he did was giving a homeless guy $10,000.
Yeah.
And that, you know, people were fascinated by that. Then he would go and he would give away cars, and he'd bring people over. They'd order pizzas and tip the guy $1,000. It's really, I think that his confidence to be able to turn down $1 billion like that is realizing that he knows the key to the universe in a way. He knows how to keep people interested in videos, but he also knows the big meta key of it all is what's in it for them. Because that's really, if you listen to what he says about what makes videos work, is you've got the first 5 seconds have to be immediately clear why this is worth watching. So it's a literal what's in it for them in that first 5 seconds is what keeps them engaged.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. The other thing is that I think that I've been reading Peter Zion. So I'm on reading number mm-hmm. 6. I've read the whole book 5 times, and I'm on reading
which one
number
now?
6.
The End of the World is just the beginning.
The End of the World. I send it out.
I just got mine yesterday.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's a big thick book. And what he's saying basically, you know, is just before one way of life starts to collapse, the amounts of dollars available get really ridiculous. So I was thinking of I don't know if you've been following the FTX.
I'm just a little bit. I don't know the details of it.
It's just that, you know, there's, you know, certainly tens of billions of dollars kind of down the drain, you know, for 1 million people because they bought into sort of a magical story of a bunch of 20-year-olds, you know, that they had come up with a secret of how you have a stable cryptocurrency, plus you're able to use your profits to do great things in the world. But basically it looks right off the offset. You know, I don't know much about it because I'm not interested ever in getting involved in the particular activity. But it looks a bit like a Ponzi scheme. You know, Ponzi, you take the money from, you keep generating new investors and you use the money from the new investors to pay off the older investors, you know. But the total value of what you're doing keeps going up in the marketplace. In other words, they got up to $32 billion, you know, and big equity firms like, you know, some of the prominent ones in Silicon Valley were giving him $200 million because of a Zoom call, you know, and everything. But it was sort of like a frenzy, that, you know, you could see a frenzy. And part of the reason is that there's more money in the American economy right now than there actually are things to invest in. And part of the reason is that everywhere in the world is trying to get its money into America right now. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways you can tell that is there's one set of numbers that I look at every morning, and it's the currency exchange between the U.S. and specifically Canada, but you know, everybody else. And the U.S. is way up against every other currency. which has a lesson to it. In fact, there's only one currency, and it's the U.S. dollar, and everything else that's called a currency is just a speculative investment that's measured, whose value is measured in terms of U.S. dollars. There's only one measurement whether of what something is worth, and it's the U.S. dollar. And part of the reason is that, and Peter Zeihan says, there's one thing that makes the global economy work, and it's unlimited, cheap, reliable transport.
Mm.
You can get anything from any place in the world to any place else in the world with great security, reliability.
I thought it's funny that as the reliability of being able to bring goods to us, the need to bring us to the goods is less important. Like I think that's the, you know what I mean? You think about our need to personally move ourselves about is less important.
Yeah. I don't have to go anywhere, actually.
I mean, isn't that funny? I went to Sarasota this week to meet up with my postcard guys. We're doing a big project, and so we had all these key people in this project.
These are actually U.S. Coast Guard?
No, from my postcard.
Oh, I thought you said Coast Guard.
No,
I said. Now, they're an important part of world transport,
yeah,
I'll tell you.
Exactly. Yeah. No, but it was so funny that it's an hour and a half away. And
people probably think we just planned that interchange. we didn't plan that.
Oh, that's so funny. But I was just realizing how much more relaxing it. Like I hit a couple of construction snags on the way there, and I'm just so used to, opening the door to my Zoom room and having access to the world right in from my home, And you realize, wow, it's just so. Yeah, I mean, it's so funny. But I had Andre Norman. Came down to see me this week. He was down for a day. And that was fun.
Yeah, he's a hoot.
Yeah, he really is.
He's such a
man. Oh, man.
Yeah.
We recorded a
smart
podcast
in our studio. Smart as a tech, though. He's got tremendous street sense. You can tell he's got tremendous street sense.
Oh, absolutely. Well, talk about, we did a,
he's got life,
we did a podcast.
He's got life or death. He's got life or death street sense. Most of us don't require to learn that. Yeah.
All right. So we recorded a podcast at the studio here. And it dawned on me, we were having the conversation. I said, talk about imagine if you applied yourself. Imagine if you applied yourself, implies that there's going to be a transformation, that you're here, but imagine if you applied yourself, you could be here. And I said, you can't imagine much more of a transformation from the basement, solitary confinement ward of a prison to being a Harvard fellow with the United Nations on speed dial. It's like such an amazing contrast and transformation. But we broke down exactly how he did it. We broke down the imagine is him having the vision that I want to be a success. I want to stay out of, like, he broke down the whole thing, how it happened. Have he ever told you or have you ever heard him talk about what he did in prison in solitary confinement? Like, he got one newspaper a month, basically. And he would read the newspaper, like every page in the newspaper, and he would solve all the problems from 20 different angles. He would think about a situation, and then he would look at it from, so let's say there's a article about a problem with the school board and the parents or something. He'd look at it from the parents' perspective and solve the problem. He'd look at it from the teachers, perspective, from the public perspective, from the kids, you know, all of it, 20 different angles. And he said, after 2 years of solving all the problems from 20 different angles, he became an expert at connecting, seeing things from all angles and being able to come up with a solution. Mm-hmm. Really fascinating, you know?
Well, there's another example of creativity lies in a smaller box, not getting out of the box you're in. I mean, solitary confinement in a prison is a pretty, pretty tiny box.
Yeah, isn't that something? It's not having access to all the information that's being printed on a daily basis.
Yeah.
It's having, once a month, having one input and putting it through an infinite way of looking at things. Was it Bruce Lee that said, "I don't fear the man who knows 10,000 kicks. I fear the man who knows one kick that he's done 10,000 times."
Yeah. That- Yeah. No, I think we've been presented with all sorts of offers, I'm not saying that our age is any different than any previous age. It's just that the means of communication are different. And what I was saying is that there's always this promise that you can get the rewards of a new capability without actually developing the capability. Yeah. And, and it didn't work in the old days and it doesn't work in the new days. You can't get good at anything unless you put in the work.
You have to apply yourself, is what you're saying.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. And you've applied yourself. You just didn't want to apply yourself to what she wanted you to apply yourself to. It's like Dan seems to have no respect for authority. Well, I do have respect for certain authority, but I'm sort of choosy about which authority I have respect for, and I think it's that zeroing in on what's really a foundation for your future that really, what certainly it's entrepreneurial intelligence that you know that all the ready-made ways of developing yourself and making a way in the world is not to your, it's not to your taste. You want to develop your own foundation. Right. That's why, I was really interested. I mean, I went right after that Mr. Beast thing turns down $1 billion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I said, that's a really useful lesson to ponder. That's a really useful thing to ponder.
Yeah,
but he laid out, if my viewership was this and we had this many Mr. Beast burgers and we had this and this, he said, I'd be interested in entertaining the price, but I think it would be $10 billion.
That's just something, isn't it?
Yeah. Somebody's out there saying, let's rearrange things.
And
get $10 billion ready, but he's making them work. He's not doing any work. He's just going on doing what he's doing. Yeah,
I get it. That's all. Yeah, it's pretty. By the way, did you know you are the same age as Neil Young?
I did not know that. Okay.
You're having a better, let's just put it this way. You're having a better experience of it than Neil appears to be having.
We were probably equal about maybe a year ago because you brought his name up and it was the first time that I actually knew who he was, which before that made us equal because he didn't know who I was.
right.
We both were equal in not knowing who the other was, Now I know who he is, I looked it up. But I was interested in him because one of my clients has created a hedge fund based on buying music libraries.
Right.
Greg Guichon here in Toronto. And I got interested in the topic, but he's not going after people like Neil Young. The long tail concept? Tail. Yeah. Well, Neil Young would be closer to the straight up line than the type of music libraries that this guy's buying. They're going down the tail, yeah. And it's between roughly the 20% mark and the 40% mark of music. And usually there are people who have, like, they've been out there for 10, 20 years, and they have steady 1,500 purchased downloads a month.
Okay.
And that's been going on forever. And it's of a particular song. And then they start looking at different songs. And they just have a very loyal lifetime audience. And that suggests predictable ongoing cash flow. And you can invest in predictable ongoing cash flow. Yeah, so... Yeah, he did a first one. He did a
52 albums.
Yeah, he did a first one, and learned a lot. Didn't like the people he was dealing with, and probably got a couple of $1 million sellout return when he sold it to a bigger library. He learned a lot, and now he went about doing it. And so it's really interesting, but if there's an audience of check writers, then you got yourself that you can buy as an investment.
Yeah. And he's at the point, like you just said something about, you reach a point where it reminded me of, total cash confidence and total cash stuff. He's two things that he talked about. I just saw an interview with him, with Rick Rubin and Lowe at Rick Rubin's studio in Malibu. And they were talking about his tour. He's like Save the Planet kind of guy now. And he wants to do a tour that is completely, sustainable kind of thing, using, biofuels and all the stuff for the entire rigs and the trucks and the power for the concerts and all of that stuff, and wants to have all of the vending at the venues, all the food, all the everything from local farms and all this stuff. And he says, we keep running into people say, well, you can't do that. You can't, it's hard to do that. And he's at the point where it's okay. If we can't do it, then we can't do it. I don't need to tour. I'm not willing to tour without those conditions. And if we can't find those, we can't make those conditions work, then that's okay. And it's so funny that, coming into a situation where it's not because he could make so much money. So I've got all the money that I could ever need. I don't need. I get to ride out the rest of my life and do exactly. I don't get to do anything that I don't want to do. And that's kind of you've said something similar. Different, I've heard you say.
It's not a bash against anything else. It's just that you're just really clear of the freedom that you've purchased in life from your past success. And you don't want to use any of the freedom that you've created as a currency to buy something less. He would be, he'd be using his freedom to buy less freedom, and he doesn't want it.
That's exactly right. It's a neat place to come from, but they were talking about recording an album that he's working on now, that they're recording it in analog, in going back to the old school kind of things to capture. They capture it in analog and immediately transfer it to digital, which I don't understand the mechanics or the logic of that, but that's what they're doing. And it's because that's what he wants to do, and he can do it.
And that's, he's got the luxury of, pondering these alternatives. It takes a lot of freedom to ponder alternatives. But it's an interesting world. But the Peter Zion book,
I'm excited to read
what
it here.
In this case, I would read. I always tell people to read
it backwards.
The conclusion But in this case, I would read the conclusion, and then I would read the introduction. Okay. And because the introduction is really gives you the, he doesn't fool around. He gets right to the point and, you know, and goes back to that discussion about transport. And he said that, he said, changes in communication don't fundamentally change us as much as changes in transportation. You know, and he said that when you live in a transportation world where it takes a long time and a big cost to get something, then there isn't a lot of economic activity. But if you get to the point where it's practically guaranteed that anything anywhere can be shipped reliably at very low cost, like less than 1% of the value, the selling value of the thing that you're selling when you get transported. And that's what it has been now for the last 20, 30 years. It's less that what you're paying for transportation is less than 1% of what you're going to sell it for or what you're going to buy it for. Then a lot of economic activity happens. And he said, now, he said, in a matter of months, we've gone from 1% to maybe 3%. Okay. And it's reflected in inflation. We can see. And people say, who's causing the inflation? He says, it's just that the transportation guarantee isn't there. You know, we're losing the transportation guarantee. And I mean, you wouldn't want to be anywhere around Eastern Europe right now, you know, because, you know, I mean, that's a troubled area. And, you know, he says that basically that area, you know, the Ukraine-Russia border and then go out 500 miles from there, he said that's now risky territory on the planet. And then the Middle East is always risky territory. And then the Chinese Taiwan thing is risky territory, he said. And so people think twice about those being shipping lanes.
I laugh when I open it. You know, I know you always like to start at the back, and I did just that. And on page 471 is the epilogue of the book. Begins 471. The epilogue begins so. That's the short version. Thanks for sticking with me. So that's the short version, 470 pages.
He's got a very unusual ability, and I haven't really come across it before that, is that he writes and talks in exactly the same style. If you've I send a link along the letter along with the book, and I just a link where he's in a debate with two young guys who have more or less the Silicon Valley attitude that technology is going to solve everything and politics doesn't mean anything and everything. And it's very interesting to watch him. It's about an hour long. And, you know, he said they were saying, well, it doesn't matter with petroleum because it's, you know, it's going to be EV 10 years from now. The whole world's going to go EV. And he said, well, he said, my heart might be with that particular prediction. But he said, I have to tell you, EVs are dead in the water. And he said, you know, only certain parts on the planet and most of them in the United States are going to be able to even afford EVs. And even there, we might not get the parts because the parts that go into the building of just the battery come from 17 different hard to get to places. And if the transportation costs for each of those parts goes up, you know, you have an EV cost being 5-10 times higher than, you know, the carbon car, you know, which basically everything's guaranteed from North America. I mean, you can pretty well get everything you need for, you know, and he just goes through and he just lays it out. He says, look, I mean, how you wish things would be and how you hope things would be, he says one thing, but there's transportation costs is not a bargainable thing. You either can pull it off or you can't pull it off. I like it. But he's got some phenomenal YouTubes. He's probably got about 50, 60 YouTubes. Some of them 3 or 4 minutes, some of them an hour and a half. Yeah. And it's just a pleasure to see how he takes things apart and puts them back together again.
Yeah, really. Amazing. Well, I can't wait to read it. I mean, they're just
Those who are listening, it's Peter Zeihan, and it's spelled Z-E-I-H-A-N. And name of the book is The End of the World is Just the Beginning, which can be taken about 3 or 4 different ways, the title.
Yeah.
And but I've read it. I've read it 5 times completely, like every page. And I'm on 6 now. And I'm just getting so much from, he's just got a very unique take on the world, which is totally counterintuitive. You know, I mean, it's just completely and totally counterintuitive.
Yeah. Well, it's going to, how much do you read in a day, Dan? Just curious how you work that into your world now.
Yeah, I actually worked that out because somebody asked me the question about a month ago. And I figured average week somewhere around 20 hours.
Then do you have a routine around it? Do you read that?
No.
Like
no.
Do you schedule it?
Pretty haphazard. It's pretty haphazard.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's articles on the internet. Sometimes it's murder mystery. I just got a new Michael Connelly murder mystery. Michael Connelly writes about a homicide cop in Los Angeles by the name of Harry Bosch. Mm-hmm. This is about number 20. And I pre-order them on my Kindle. And it's like a birthday. It's like a birthday treat. You open it in the morning and something you pre-ordered and even forgot about pops up on your screen. And I said, this'll keep me busy for 3 or 4 days.
I love it.
I'm pretty haphazard. I'm pretty, I mean, what's your AD for if you can't utilize it?
Exactly. Can't be a toddler at the picnic every now and then.
Oh, I have a request. I have a client here in Canada who's created a podcast. His name's Andre Brisson, and he's created a podcast on AD for entrepreneurial ADD. And he wants to know if Dean Jackson would agree to give his insights if he was invited.
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to.
Yeah.
I always love talking about that. So he's ADD.
Andre Brisson.
Okay.
No, he's an entrepreneur who's worked through it himself. And, I've given him some guidance. He's in his 40s probably. So, he hasn't been out there as long as we have, Dean.
Right.
And some of us longer than that. And some of us longer than others,
We've been not applying ourselves longer.
It takes a while to turn this distractibility into a business model.
That's right. Oh, that's so funny. I love it. Yes, but happy to. Happy to do that. That would be great.
Okay,
I do love a good podcast.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And he'll be a good host for you, and he'll give you free rein to go anywhere you want to go.
I love
which
it. That's
is only
my favorite
suitable
way.
For which is only suitable for the topic.
That's exactly right. I can't wait.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll be on to next week. Next week, and happy Thanksgiving. We're celebrating on Thursday here. We get 2 Thanksgivings.
Company wide.
The Canadian in October and this one. And
nice.
Same meal though. It's turkey.
Okay, well that's right.
Yeah.
I love it.
Thanks
a lot,
Dan.
Thanks. I'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Okay, bye.